And that's what I teach. I think, and when I teach workshops and mold making or hand building or whatever it is, it's how do you solve problems and how do you give tools to people in order to solve those problems? And how do you like not get dismayed or defeated by problems? Because that's what life is. It's a series of problems that you have to learn how to solve. And, you know, sometimes it seems easy and sometimes it doesn't.
Hi, this is Daphne Cohn, and welcome to episode 15 of the Creativity Habit Podcast. Conversations about art, creativity, and courage with artists, creatives, and makers. My guest today is a potter with his own studio and the creator of The Bright Angle, a business bridging technology and craft. The Bright Angle is a collective of artists who are disrupting the ceramic pottery industry by using science and technology to bring handmade objects from local artists to a mass market through a personally designed, systemized process. A process that combats throwaway culture through high-quality materials that are meant to last. The founder and my guest is Nick Moen, and you can find him over at thebrightangle.com. Now, this interview is a bit different from the typical conversation at the Creativity Habit Podcast. In this interview, we talk a little bit about Nick and his work, but the focus is on The Bright Angle, because if you're listening to this before June 3rd, The Bright Angle is in the midst of a Kickstarter campaign that ends on June 3rd. I wanted to share with you this amazing project while you can still contribute, and if you do contribute, you'll get one of their beautiful ceramic handmade goods. Now, I'm not an affiliate. I have no financial investment in this collective. My interest is in supporting artists who are innovating, disrupting, and elevating the world through their art and creativity, and The Bright Angle does just that. In this interview, we talk about creative problem solving, the challenges of collaboration, how to run a successful Kickstarter campaign, why it matters where your things come from, and how to have more with less. And then at the end of the interview, you'll also hear from the four other members of The Bright Angle Collective. May you enjoy this conversation and may it inspire you to make your thing and change your world. Welcome, Nick, to the Creativity Habit Podcast. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me, Daphne.
Yeah, you're welcome. So the way I like to start is with your creativity story. And I know that this is kind of a unique interview because we're going to go a lot more in depth around what you're creating right now, which is The Bright Angle. But just to give a little background, share some of your creativity story as a boy, like how creativity and art were part of your life, if they were.
Sure. Well, I think my earliest memories of being creative were when I was a kid. I had like foreign au pairs. There was always creativity and language around me, which I think definitely influenced me. But I distinctly remember drawing a lot of astronaut drawings and dinosaur drawings. I was really fascinated with science. And so I think it all kind of rooted from science and language more so than maybe than like drawing or painting, even though that was definitely part of my childhood.
So the science piece, is that also in your mind, is that connected to technology, or are those two separate fields?
No, I think they definitely are. I think that my creativity kind of stemmed from like a problem solving part of it all. So there was always another problem to solve. It's kind of indicative of the struggle of the artist, is that it's never quite done. Something can always be better, because if something was good enough, then you'd stop making, you know? And so there's always like one more better thing or the next best thing to do when making or problem solving. And I think that all kind of rips back to the scientific method too, is like, well, what's next? Like, what else can we discover? And so I think that for me, the creativity might have had less to do maybe with my hands or with materials, but more a mental creativity, I guess.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, even though you are also very creative with your hands, with pottery and with the things that you make. So, but that does bring us right into The Bright Angle, which is bringing science together with art, technology with art. So tell me what The Bright Angle is.
Well, the Bright Angle started off as kind of an idea of putting a number of people together in a space. And, you know, ultimately I'm the boss of everything, or the facilitator, and that's how I like to look at it. But I couldn't have done any of it alone. And so essentially we're a group of people, and we're tool makers and problem solvers and designers we're very much involved with how objects play roles in our daily life. So, for example, we all just used our pour over that we just designed, and it has two slots. So, like, two people at a time are using pour overs and making coffee. And so there's this whole aspect of sharing, too. And I'm actually in the studio right now, so you can hear somebody in the background banging out a model from a mold. I should probably frame that and let you know that that'll be happening in the background.
I want to say a little bit before we dive deeper, because this is a different type of interview than I normally do, just to give a little bit of background, which is to let you know, folks listening know, that the Bright Angle, the reason that I'm doing the interview like this is that right now Nick and the Bright Angle are in the middle of a Kickstarter campaign. And when I found out what they were doing, I thought, this is so cool. I really want to get it out there. And I want to get it out there before the Kickstarter campaign is over. So you may be listening to it after it's ended. But if you're not, this is one of the reasons I want Nick to talk about what he's doing and what the Bright Angle is because I think this art really makes a difference in the world. It's really important that we look at art as a way of creating a more sustainable, healthy planet for all of us. And that's exactly what Nick is up to with the Bright Angle. So we're going to dive into what the Bright Angle is and all the ways that it can affect our lives on a personal and global level. So Nick, with the Bright Angle, one of the intention behind it, as I understand it, is, as you write, to bridge the gap between design and craft. So talk about what that means a little bit.
Sure. So kind of my history as an artist or my private studio practice, I grew up in Minnesota, and there's a huge pottery community there. And there's kind of a term called Minge Soda. And so Minge Soda is the idea that pots should be made accessible. And that whole thing actually was rooted in a practice that Bernard Leach in England started. And so he kind of started this idea of studio pottery. Studio pottery is, you know, the isolated artist that works in a studio and moves through bodies of work and ideas. And then there were different models of how to sell pots. And I think that that's actually the business side of it is a huge facet that's really interesting about the Bright Angle. Because what happened is I left school and I wanted to be a full-time artist or a full-time potter. And it seemed like it'd been so easy for, you know, generations before me, because they could show up at a craft fair and put out all their pots and they would sell and make a living. And I'd seen it happen again and again. And so that was my first stab at being a full-time potter or artist. Is I traveled around the country in my Prius. I'd pack up tens of thousands of dollars worth of pots and strapping my roof and stuff. And I'd be on the road for months setting up at craft shows. But unfortunately, what I realized is these craft shows, the collector class was aging. It wasn't necessarily like the hippest thing for millennials to go and do. So I was really interested in what had changed, you know, what sort of habits new collectors had, and, you know, how to turn them on, like how to remind them that we're still making things by hand, like your neighbor's still making things by hand, and not everything is disconnected or mass produced, part of the whole disposable culture. Like, there's authenticity and a story behind everything that is around you every day. But ideally, the craft aspect of that is the idea that somebody understands the materials and the process well enough, and they studied that, where the things that they're making are really well intentioned and really thoughtful. That was kind of my struggle, is like, well, what's working? What does the collector class now look like? The people that are starting to make things, new things, part of their lives, or getting houses, or, you know, having weddings, getting married, like, how are they absorbing the special things into their lives? And it seemed like design was the new trend, or that was the word, or the framework that people were actually consuming in. And, you know, I don't use consuming as a bad thing, because I think that if you consume the right things, you can have really wonderful objects around you and really wonderful lifestyles because of those objects. But it's definitely been polluted by industry, because we're so inundated with crap that ends up in landfills in the middle of the ocean. And there's got to be something done about that.
Which is one of the reasons that I thought this was so important. And I want to say something actually before we go further again, because one of the things that holds us back from buying, say, a nice mug or plate or something that's made by a craftsperson is often the price.
Sure.
I think that to keep in mind, because I know it's held me back before, but at the same time, I'm realizing as I'm talking with you that I have salad bowls that I eat off of every single day that were wedding gifts to my mom and stepfather back in 1981.
Wow,
and I'm using them every single day. So we can also think of it that way when we look at something like this and go, oh, well, this is all nice, but it's so expensive. It's so that they have a long shelf life, these things. And that's one of the things that you talk about is it being made to last and not being a bunch of disposable stuff. Actually, one of the things that you write about as part of the intention with the Bright Angle is that rather than having a bunch of disposable stuff made in a different country by unknown hands or machines, this is about making things around you that you need or want. So share a little of why that is so important.
I want to start off, let's be clear that stuff breaks too, you know? So even though you've had those bowls for decades now, they still break. But the idea is that if you really care about the things that are around you, when something breaks, your heart breaks too, because you love those things, you know, you create stories with them. They're part of your daily rituals. And so I think that on like a very fundamental level and thinking about kind of living with a minimal number of objects, like why not invest in objects that are going to allow you to have those stories, you know, that are really meaningful, that you're not worried about spending so much because it might break. It's just the bad mentality. And if somebody says that, I usually say, well, then be more careful. But if something that you have and you love breaks, you should be heartbroken, because those things that, you know, are part of your daily rituals and daily life, they should mean something to you, because all of those rituals that you have that's your identity.
And I'll just add in that one of those bowls is glued back together, which I wouldn't do with a plate that I bought at like Bed Bath & Beyond.
No. Yeah, that would end up in a landfill. But fortunately, you know, if it's ceramic, it's just going to be shards and archaeologists will find it in
thousands of years.
But yeah, I mean, unless it was plastic, and that's a whole nother, you know, story. But I think going back to the price point too, that's one thing that we're struggling with, and like setting price points for my own work when I was just hitting the road was difficult, because it was hard to justify selling a $40 or $50 mug when you could buy one for $5 at the store. But what's happened with manufacturing and automated systems and cheap labor, foreign labor, is that all the prices and everything's been devalued. So you go overseas and you have something manufactured really inexpensively. And sure, you know, the Chinese they pioneered ceramics. I mean, they invented porcelain from a mountain of kaolin, which is what the main material in porcelain is. And the Europeans fought for hundreds of years on how to get the porcelain. I mean, there was like wars about it. So they definitely know how to make ceramics, but we're dealing with like an economic thing here where the price point on everything is inflated because labor is so cheap. And so the Bright Angle, we're bringing light manufacturing almost, or like production systems back here, but we're paying wages that we should all probably be getting paid more, but it's like a real value. Like I sit down with spreadsheets and I calculate exactly how many minutes goes into every piece and how to include the overhead and the way the studio is being used. And so everything we're making is actually how much it costs. Right now, it's actually really interesting politically, because there's people in office that are talking about bringing jobs back to America. And what they don't realize is that if that happens, unless we fully automate everything with machines, like all the prices on everything that we buy will go up, unless there's government subsidies or subsidies from nonprofits. But this is like a really real aspect of everything, is that we're like actually creating something with a real value. There's no falsehood in how we price things. And so when people balk at how much the price of a handmade thing is, even though, you know, we're doing things very efficiently here, and that's one beautiful part of the technology being integrated with the craft at the Bright Angle, is that we're very efficient in the systems we create and the tools we make to create those systems. And but yeah, the price point, that's a whole, I mean, the value of objects needs to go up. And I think a lot of that has to do with educating the millennials and the collector class about what actually goes into making.
And the other piece that you said, Nick, too, about you have fewer objects, but the objects that you have matter more. So that's another conversation, but even just to bring that in as a little piece of that is a possibility. We live in a culture where we don't talk about that very much, but it is possible to just have less and have what we have mean more.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I'm helping a friend move right now, and she's packing everything up, and seeing her choose what's worth keeping, what's not, and like the basket of throwaway stuff. It's like, man, we acquire so many things. It's just like content online. Like, we're so hungry for things and content, and everything's so accessible and easy. But fortunately, one huge benefit about being in Asheville is that there's a really thriving craft and maker culture here, because Penland School of Craft is here, and Warren Wilson College, Haywood Community College, Aramont's, you know, an hour away. So there's all these craft schools, and so really beautiful, thoughtful things with amazing stories are made at all these places. And it's really easy to get involved in that and not only make things that have a story about how you made them, but actually like acquire really wonderful things from all these artists. And that ultimately goes back and combats this idea of disposable culture, where you buy something to throw away or you buy something to return, when really you should save your money and invest in something that's going to mean a lot, that's going to be the first thing that you pack up and move. Because those are the objects that have those stories. And we've been actually thinking a lot about music and how you listen to old playlists that you find and dig up, and it brings up all these memories about past love or points in your life where really traumatic things were happening or amazing things were happening. And this is something we experience or deal with on a day-to-day basis with all these objects, is that they're almost like songs from the past. They bring up all these memories about the people that made them or where we got them or the times we've shared with them. And it's just kind of ironic that there are all these pop stars that are creating music that make you feel these things. And maker culture and handmade culture, we all kind of understand that the objects do that too. But right now it feels like a secret that we like get all these feelings from these amazing objects that are around us. And it's one of those things that the millennials just don't know yet.
Is this, Nick, what you meant? Because in an article that was called Dying with the Makers, you wrote, as do most makers of functional work, I collect the handmade and integrate thoughtful objects into my everyday routine. The ritual of bringing useful things out of storage and into use accumulates in our memory.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And that project, Dining with Makers, was kind of an opportunity to create an experience with these handmade objects where people could come that didn't collect handmade things yet or didn't understand the value of all these things. And they could come to a restaurant and eat like a multi-course meal and experience handmade glasses and handmade plates. And there was one dinner where we had handmade bone marrow spoons. And so we were like really creating this experience, because we've realized that the millennials they're spending a lot of money and time on experiences rather than like setting up their lifestyles maybe. And so you go out and they'll spend hundreds of dollars on a really nice dinner. So we were trying to set up an experience for them to be able to understand where we were coming from, or give them a taste of what it's like to use objects that are really thoughtful, that have a story. And you can sit next to the person that made it and talk to them about their life. And it's not necessarily that they're a maker, but it's just this like empathy, like tools of empathy. So you can like understand people's stories, and having empathetic objects that connect us is, I don't know, I think it's a really beautiful thing.
It is. You made a connection for me just now that I hadn't had, because it's true. We separate out things from experiences, and we'll say, oh yes, I'm going to spend my money on experiences because that's what I'll remember, and we don't need all these things. And it's a waste to be spending so much on things when what we really want are the experiences. And what I love about what you just said was you just bridged those two worlds for me, that the things can be experiences if we invest in them in the same way that we would invest in an experience, and seeing the whole story behind it, the importance, the maker behind it, everything that brought it to, you know, what it is today, and also the role that it plays in our life. And then that becomes an experience in and of itself.
Totally. Yeah. Well, and we have these experiences every day. So being able to put 22, we had one dinner where there was like 90 people that dined with us, and putting them in our shoes for one night to be able to experience those things. We're like, hey, you can do this every day when you eat. It's like kind of like a mandatory habit. Everyone has to eat, you know? And so that seems like the first step in how we can integrate handmade objects, specifically with ceramics and glass. You know, those are like two things that we at the Bright Angle are like focus on, although we've added wood and leather and other materials too. But yeah,
it's great. I love that. So another thing that another intention that you have on the website is you say, I would like our studio to be a place to incorporate design with handmade. So many objects in our lives are disposable because most of the time the designer is disconnected from the maker and material. Most ceramic ware is designed on a computer by people who have never made a pot. In these cases, the designer has no concept of the material and may never even touch the item they have designed. They have no grasp on the material they are designing with, or the process in which it will be made. This is a very tangible disconnect. So talk to me about the consequences of this disconnect.
Sure. The heart of that conversation starts with maybe like the authenticity of the objects. And so a lot of industrial design happens on the computer, you know, starting with sketches, which is also how we're working. But what's really unique about us is that we're actually implementing the production process as the design process is happening. You know, we're working with a few big retailers, and we're having discussions with like Scandinavian design companies, because a lot of them are designing things to be made in factories overseas. So there's a few issues with that. Is one, they're designing something without thinking about how they're going to be made. So if you design a plate, there's a very specific process of how that should be made efficiently, like very specific tools that should be used. But if you're just on the computer, you don't realize the limitations or constraints of the materials. And in fact, a lot of the time, if you're designing a plate, you don't know. Maybe it's going to be plastic at the end, or maybe it's going to be ceramic. But ultimately, like, you send it off, and then these people in these factories have to try and translate those three-dimensional designs into something tangible, into a product. But what we're doing is we're actually sitting down with the whole team and everyone that's touching and producing the things, and we're saying, hey, how can we make this the most efficient system? Like, what model can we use, and what mold system can we use to make that model reproducible in the smartest and most efficient way? So like, not only is it saving time and money with efficiency, but it's also like creating something that is really smart as a design, because we're really integrating the materials knowledge with the products. And it allows us actually to push materials. Right now we're focusing a lot on porcelain. We're able to actually push the materials as part of the design process. So we're doing work with translucent porcelain, and we're being very conscious of the way we're using glazes or unglazed porcelain, and the tolerances of all that end up being very tight and manageable, you know, especially since in the building that we're in, we have a maker space next door. So they have 3D printers and a laser cutter and CNC router. And fortunately, I studied some 3D modeling when I was in college. And so I'm able to take sketches from people in the studio or artists and put them onto the computer and start to make prototypes very quickly. And so we're able to move through sketches into three-dimensional models really quickly, which, you know, I mean, ultimately we can have something sketched and out of a kiln in 2 weeks, which is a really unique system that we have set up. And it would only be possible, like, number one, in Asheville, but also working with small batches in this kind of studio. And I mean, I'm surrounded by amazing makers, so I'm really fortunate. And all these makers are craftspeople. They understand the material. And actually, a lot of craftspeople, the hardest thing to do is actually point out how important a ruler is or dimensioning, and you don't really realize you need that until you start putting things on the computer and translating them into 3D printed models or, you know, CNC routed prototypes, because they're so used to carving or sketching by hand, like on the potter's wheel, or using plaster to sketch, or using tools to work reductively or additively. One thing that I've taught here especially is, like, you walk around with a ruler and you can measure your life. You figure out what size things are and how they fit. Like, what size is your hand? Like, what are the things you're holding? And what does it take to make those things comfortable or fit proportionally with your hand, or the actions you make with your hand? Like, how do you make objects or tools that are an extension of your body?
I'm curious, with making this such a efficient process and measuring everything and and looking at it from this very scientific and technological perspective, have you had any negative response from makers who say, hey, like each piece is unique and you're turning something into a process that's not meant to be this type of process? Have you encountered any of that?
No one said it to my face, I guess. But I remember when I first got introduced to mold systems in plaster, I was in college in Portland, Oregon. And I remember talking to my professor and saying, man, this stuff is just like really lifeless because it seems like there's no connection to the hand or touch. I was missing kind of like the marks of the maker. And what I realized is that the tools I was using then are like the potter's wheel, you know, and the potter's wheel is a tool to make things round. And there's like a number of maker's marks or toolings that happen when you're making something on the potter's wheel. And so mold systems are the way that we're producing things are the same kind of thing. Like with molds, there's always seams. And so it's a matter of kind of introducing those seams into the pieces in the smartest way. So they're either hidden or exposed, but they're there. You know, no matter how you make something, there's always going to be remnants of the process involved. And, you know, I think some people definitely think that what we're doing might be a shortcut, like using molds. I just posted something about the Kickstarter Reddit board and they're like, oh, you guys are using slip casting and molds and it's not authentic or it's cheating. And it's not really cheating. It's like actually using technology and making tools to make things we want to make again and more efficiently. And actually it's a really involved and complicated process to make the models and make the molds. And there's nothing really easy about it by any means. And when we hear those people respond to us that way, we laugh because the amount of skill and thoughts and time it takes into setting up all these tools and systems is extensive. I mean, right now we have Shannon Tovey, who's the resident designer, and she's currently making molds both out of rubber and plaster so that we can reproduce the things from the collection. And she's incredibly skilled. The way that she handles the material and thinks about it is just like working with the finished product. Each of the molds that we use are pieces of art in themselves. And I think you can see some on the website, but the way they fit together and the way they work, it's incredibly important. And there's really nothing easy about it.
And you also, I know that a piece of the Bright Angle, and you've mentioned this, is like each person in the collective is part of each piece that gets produced. Correct. So it's, yeah, like it's totally a collective effort from start to finish.
Yeah, definitely. So we meet every Monday and we kind of check in because right now everyone has like a fairly solidified role, just both on like what they like to do, but then they kind of settled into a role of they're really good at. We kind of meet and talk about the steps in the process and who's doing the right thing or setting up the process to be easier for the next person. But really the idea with the Bright Angle for me is to be able to facilitate handmade design and try and figure out how to make cohesive things fit so the ideas that we're releasing aren't really cluttered. And so with this collection, we started in December with a design questionnaire to think about what we wanted to make, what made sense for us to make, kind of how we would make it, who we were selling to. And that's kind of how we came up with what the collection is now, which will continue to expand because we're able to introduce products fairly rapidly with the way that we're working here. I wanted to involve my employees. I wanted them to feel connected to the Bright Angle and feel connected to the process and the products we're making because they're so important. I mean, I frequently say that, the Bright Angle is them. Like I couldn't have done it without them. And there's been, I don't know, maybe like 10 to 15 people that have been working here in the past 9 months, like both setting up the studio, or actually the past year now, but it's both setting up the studio and jumping in, you know, for the holidays for projects that we were working on. Most notably is the Democratic Cup, which was also a really interesting project. But that started with bringing in other potters' designs from their own studio practice and then figuring out ways to reproduce them so we could make, you know, dozens to hundreds of them. And so with this collection, it was, I kind of approached each person and I knew what their own studio practice was like or their own art. And I tried to figure out how to integrate their personal interests and their art into what was going to be or what is now a cohesive collection. So each person was involved specifically in the design of one piece, at least, other than the resident designer, Shannon Tovey, who her marks are all over every piece. But then the process too, like we have a very strong cohesive system on how everything's made. And we talk about the process, you know, weekly. I mean, really every day we're problem solving each part of it, but then weekly we sit down and we really hash it out and talk about how things are going and how things are coming out and where we can do better.
Have you found, having been a solo entrepreneur for a while, have you found it to be challenging to move into a more collaborative enterprise, or has that been a fairly easy transition?
Nothing's been more difficult, probably. I mean, there's this guy, Ernesto Cirilli. He's a good family friend. He had a podcast. I ended up talking to a couple of weeks ago, and he does kind of entrepreneur coaching, and he's got a really amazing foundation for small business and entrepreneurship. And he said that, you know, you're an entrepreneur when you wake up in the middle of the night screaming. I was like, well, I don't sleep much anyway, so I don't wake up. But yeah, it's like, you know, and then adding other people to the mix and figuring out how to communicate effectively and make sure that the dynamic in the studio is productive and positive, especially when everything is stressful or there's, I mean, it's problem solving. And that's what we do, is like there's one problem after the other, whether it be marketing or finances or production or a piece of equipment or, man, I mean, just everything. It, you know, I've created this community and small family, which, you know, will continue to grow and change. And we're bringing another resident artist in 2 weeks, actually, that'll be here for the summer. And so it'll be shifting and evolving, but I'm trying to set up a home base or a record label to allow people to come through and be creative. You know, all these people were working at coffee shops or restaurants or bars to begin with, and I wanted to give them an avenue to actually be involved in what they went to school for in their career. And then having them design parts of the collection made them really connected. So that's really amazing. I'm super, super lucky and grateful to be surrounded by these people, but also it's definitely a daily struggle. I mean, if somebody's in a bad mood, then the goal for the day is to make them laugh or something, which is fun, but it's definitely very different from the solo studio practice that I had before. And I worked at Odyssey Clayworks, which is a residency program in Asheville, which was amazing. And I learned a lot about community there from the director, Gabriel Klein. And he's a huge mentor for me. But then I worked in my basement as well, alone. And it was dark and dank and lonely. And yeah, and it's definitely an upgrade there. But it's, you know, it presents a whole new set of problems, but also opportunities.
Yeah, are there particular things, like a couple things that you keep in mind when challenges arise, or is there a part of just the core values of the Bright Angle that help you work through this piece? Because I know this is why a lot of things fall apart, is the relationship aspect of it.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we communicate, and you know, to be honest, I've, you know, had one-on-ones with every single person, and sometimes it's personal things going on in their lives, or sometimes it's how they need to be talked to or communicated with in order to be the most productive or happy. But yeah, I mean, it's a family, and I keep saying this, but at the end of the day, it's like goes back to problem solving. And I believe and have so much confidence in each one of the people here that they can solve problems. And sure, I can usually typically facilitate how to solve those problems, but they're all so smart and talented that a lot of the time they are able to solve these problems on their own. And that's what I teach. I think, and when I teach workshops and mold making or hand building or whatever it is, it's how do you solve problems and how do you give tools to people in order to solve those problems? And how do you like not get dismayed or defeated by problems? Because that's what life is. It's a series of problems that you have to learn how to solve. And you know, sometimes it seems easy and sometimes it doesn't.
That's right. The other thing I wanted to underscore in what you said a little earlier was just how this is the other piece of when we buy, say, a vase or we buy a mug from the Bright Angle, as opposed to like Target or some big chain store, that in the case of the Bright Angle, we're supporting artists who, as you said, Nigar, like previously were working maybe in restaurants or cafes or some type of service industry job. This is supporting them to do what it is that not only they went to school for or have worked on, but is truly what their passion is about. It's like what they can contribute to us, to everybody. And I just think that is such an important piece of art, because we need art. We need creativity. It's essential to not just our lives now, but moving forward in the world that we're living in. And anything that we do to support those who are making actually adds more value to our lives, to underscore that.
Yeah. Well, and I think that a lot of that was possible through the systems that we created in order to allow other people to come in. So yeah, they all had other jobs before, and you know, my main role was to be able to create systems where I could plug in other people that had skill sets, and they're incredibly skilled. That's kind of what you have to set up, and it's hard. You know, the solo studio practice may not typically have systems that allow you to disattach or let parts of those processes go. And that's been a huge struggle here too, is like talking with solo studio artists about allowing us to make something for them. And they're like, well, it's hard to like kind of let go of that idea or those toolings or the way that they make stuff. But our role or our job is to facilitate kind of designing systems to allow that to happen, because there's a lot of hands that go into touching each thing.
I want to talk a little bit about the Kickstarter campaign, since that's right now where you guys are at. And I know, well, first of all, I know that it says it took a year to build this whole studio. And you said that you've been dreaming up the Bright Angle for a few years now. I'm curious what took it from idea to 2D planning to a Kickstarter campaign and a studio and all that's happening with it now.
Sure. I went to Alfred University and graduated in 2012. And I actually shared a studio with Shannon Tovey, who's now master mold maker, resident designer, before she heads off to grad school in London in the fall. But we shared a studio, and it was really amazing having a number of people in one spot, even though we were working individually and there wasn't a lot of collaboration, because I think that in America, at least in school or creative endeavors, you're typically taught to like think as an individual and kind of work alone. But I realized I had a lot of spaces that they weren't my strong suits. I don't know that I have a lot of strong suits. I think that each of those strong suits are just places for other people to support me and or vice versa. But I was thinking about a model of how to set up a collaborative system of making and learning and education through production as well. So I moved into this building in the river or in the south slope of Asheville called the Refinery about a year ago. And there's 18 artists in the building, and the Asheville Area Arts Council has a gallery here. And so we kind of facilitated and curated all the artists in the building. I decided to open up the space because I'd gone to a show in New York called New York Now, which is a gift show, and it went pretty well. It seemed like there was still a market, even after traveling around the country doing craft shows, it seemed like there was still a market and people shopping wholesale. So that was really optimistic. And so I thought, well, maybe there's an opportunity here to set up a bigger studio, and I've learned how to create systems using molds. So I was fairly confident, but also pretty crazy, I think, to think that I could just kind of set up a studio and it would all fall into place. But that's kind of what happened. I mean, we moved in a year ago, and all of my personal stuff was sitting on the floor, and I was alone, and I had a couple friends that were like plumbers and electricians and creative people in their own right. They were like, so what are you going to do with the place? And I was like, I don't know. I guess I need shelves first, you know? And I think I spent like 2 weeks deciding what kind of shelves to make. And I ended up building a wood shop in the studio first. And then we ended up building pretty much everything from scratch, from the shelves to the tables to the kiln, the way we move porcelain around the studio. A good friend of mine made the spray booth, and another one did the plumbing and electrical. And so we like really did all that from scratch too. And it felt really good to figure out start with kind of like a handmade foundation of actually like DIY building everything ourselves. And it was a lot cheaper. Fortunately, I don't have like a big bankroll to kind of fund everything. It was all fairly organic. And so it was all sweat equity, you know, a lot of labor went into it. And we picked up a few projects from the get-go, and we're still making Nick Moen Studio stuff, which is kind of my brand that I sell to museum gift shops and galleries, which I love, and it's been a lot of fun. But I kind of wanted something to hide behind a little, because I was kind of sick of going to shows and, you know, being on display myself. And I always felt more confident being able to sell other people's work or the work of others or talk about them. And that really excited me. And so I wanted to figure out a way to do that. But then one really super exciting project that we started with, and I collaborated with this amazing woman, Ayumi Hori, who's a potter and social activist in Maine, was the Democratic Cup. And so she approached me a little over a year ago and said that she'd found a group of potters that were willing to send down models, and she was wondering if we could reproduce some porcelain cups that we'd end up putting imagery on decals that pushed progressive issues or just issues in general. I think we launched that in the fall before the election, but we ended up making over 900 cups, and we learned a lot about what American light manufacturing was or production, and working with other people's models and trying to translate their pots into something reproducible. Because all these potters, some of the best potters in the country, it was really amazing to get their models in the studio, and then really challenging to try and make multiples of those pots and teach people that didn't know how to reproduce those pots or never touched those pots in their life, like how to touch them in order to make them the best we could.
Yeah, that part was challenging, figuring all of that out. And then, as you mentioned earlier, the sign of an entrepreneur is when you wake up screaming in the middle of the night, and collaborating has been challenging. So what keeps you going through all of this? What's keeping you inspired when it's like one challenge or one problem to solve after another?
Sure. Well, I always joke that I never give up, but I give up every day. Like, there's always like a moment where I like sigh. I'm like, oh man, another problem. But I think that's what it is I've kind of convinced myself that every problem can be solved. And so it's just a matter of solving those problems. And I think that that's what keeps me going too, is like, oh man, I'm never bored. There's always like something else to do. I think that the day I was bored is the day I'd give up. And I think I'm a fairly like intense and emotionally sensitive person. So I think that those things amplify my vigor and passion for doing all these things. But now it's turned into me figuring out how much I can support the people around me, which has always really been my goal. But I want to give them good jobs, and I want them to be making things that they want to make, and I want them to be joking in the studio and having a good time, and I want the Bright Angle to be a brand that supports that. And that is the story, that we're like supporting studio artists that are otherwise isolated or working jobs to kind of get by and maybe support their practice on the side, but trying to really create a brand or a system that's about sharing and working together and having fun. I mean, we have a blast in here. There's definitely tough days, but I get to come to work, and I don't think any of us, I always check in with everybody, but I don't think any of us like wake up and don't want to go to work. I think maybe we wake up and sometimes turn over and want to sleep a little more. But yeah, there's never like a dread of going to work, because we're like hanging out. We're having a blast.
That's so great. So as of the time of this recording, you've raised around $20,000 with your Kickstarter campaign. And the goal is?
I think it's 25.
25,
so we're shooting
okay.
For 25, yeah. And the reason why we're doing it with the Kickstarter is, well, we wanted to release a collection, like a cohesive collection where everyone like collaborated on stuff and the glaze kind of ties together. But also we needed a way to like launch the brand and launch the idea. And we could have done it just on a website, or we could have brought it to market. We're going to bring it to market in New York in August, where we'll talk to retailers, you know, anywhere from a mom and pop tea shop to Crate and Barrel or Target. We'll see how the market responds to it, but we wanted a platform where we could very easily share the idea. And so, you know, we were able to bring in a really amazing filmmaker, Kevin Eubanks, to do video. And then we brought in some amazing branders, Drew DePorter and Mikey Abel. They've all helped out a lot. But it seems like a really good platform that we can share on social media, because that's kind of how people are buying things, are learning about things. And so we were trying to figure out the best way to kind of launch everything at once. And going back, we probably would have, and when we launch new things, we'll probably do like small Kickstarters at a time, or crowdfunding campaigns at a time, because they are a really good way to put things into production. But most of the things on Kickstarter are technology inventions or games or single products. And that's actually what they're doing, is they're pre-selling them in order to manufacture them overseas. And And so we're doing the same thing, except for we're pre-selling them to manufacture in-house. And so we're not shipping anything overseas. The labor is staying here in America to give these wonderful people jobs. But it seemed like the best way to introduce and kind of introduce the brand and introduce the collection. But also we need to know how many molds to make of things. We want to gauge what products are really desirable or sell well and what we should market, which things get press. And because then we have a better idea of how to use the studio, figure out studio capacity, like how much to invest in setup costs and making the molds and kind of production costs and making things.
So I realize that it's the Kickstarter campaign is not over yet. And that's the reason we're doing, as I mentioned earlier, the reason we're doing the interview now. It goes until June 3rd. So you may or may not be listening to it before it's over. If it's not over yet, then as I mentioned in the introduction, definitely go to The Bright Angle and check it out. Are there pieces that you have learned about running a successful Kickstarter campaign? I know the goal is 25,000 and I absolutely believe that you'll get there. And at this point, having raised 20,000, that's definitely in my mind a successful campaign. Are there things that you've learned to make that happen?
Well, it seems like a game every day, like kind of putting out content and doing social media marketing and figuring out like what kind of ads we need and how to put together a mailing list and sending all that out. But it's like, it's a big equation and there's so many resources online. I can't really specify anything directly, but talking to other people that have done successful campaigns is probably the biggest help. And then we have this guy that just helped a company that made shoes. He's been really integral in putting everything together and putting the Kickstarter together. But I think probably the simplest way to break it down is that it kind of works in three waves. And so the first wave is turning to family and friends. And if you're ever trying to sell something or start a business or do anything, you kind of turn to them first because that's what you have. And they want to support you. If you're excited about it, then they'll get excited about it. So that was kind of the first step, is to turn to people close to me and my family and friends and kind of set a baseline for how the campaign would set off. And then from there, ideally, it was the second wave. So the peripheral people, like their friends. So, you know, the friends of friends. And then we've gotten a little bit of press on a couple publications, and we just sent some stuff to Apartment Therapy. We'll see when they end up doing the coffee pour over special. So that's kind of the second wave. And then the third wave is going back and saying, hey, this is about to end. We really need your support in order to complete this goal. Or even if we reach our goal, then there's reach goals. So Shannon Tovey designed this spoon. So if we do reach our goal, if we do 30,000, then we'll release a Shannon Tovey spoon, which is really amazing. And it goes with the coffee pour over set. Yeah, I mean, really, you know, I guess going back to it all, it starts with family and friends, no matter when you're selling or sharing any idea. Where my parents are incredible, amazing people, and I've got a really amazing friend group that have been so supportive. So I think that, you know, that's kind of the foundation, no matter what you're doing, because if you're passionate and excited about something, then they will be too.
Which is perfect, since The Bright Angle is so much about supporting friends, family, creating community. So it's a perfect way to kick it off. Before I finish with the last couple questions, is there something that I haven't asked you that you want to make sure gets talked about?
I think that I've covered a lot of what I'd usually like to say about this project. I'm so excited. And I think that hopefully that translates in, you know, the video and imagery that we share and the stories and kind of the voice and what The Bright Angle is so far. We're really excited about it. And we're hoping that the idea spreads too, and that there's other places throughout the country that are working. And there are. We just hosted Pots in Action, which is an Instagram feed that Ayumi Hore started. And we did a whole series on systems and like how to create systems in order to incorporate other people in your process, or just tools, like how to make efficient systems with tools, because that's, you know, that's kind of the technology that we implement here. So I think, yeah, really like just conveying the excitement and how lucky and grateful I am to be surrounded by amazing people. And yeah.
And it does, the campaign does convey that excitement, because I found out about you guys. I went over to the Kickstarter campaign knowing nothing about what you were up to. And I was just like, oh my God, this is so cool. And I showed it to my friends. I showed it to my family. I was like, you guys got to check this out. This is really cool. So it's in there. It's definitely
convenient. Okay. Thanks, Daphne.
Yeah. And so for folks who want to learn more about The Bright Angle, go to thebrightangle.com. And there's a big link there to the Kickstarter campaign if this is before June 3rd that you're listening to this. And even and if it's after, just check it out. See what they're doing. I mean, this is art that's making a difference. This is matters. It really matters. So the last two things, one is just to express my appreciation for you, Nick, and for The Bright Angle. And I have expressed it throughout this interview, but I am so inspired by people like you, inspired by you. When, you know, you hear that calling, you feel you have the impulse to make a difference with your art and to go through all that you have to go through to do that. Like you said, every day, you quit every day. I mean, there's challenges all the time. There's problems all the time. And the fact that you persevere and keep solving them and solving them in collaboration with others, which I know is really what it's amazing, and it's also one of the most challenging ways to operate. The fact that you guys keep doing this, and you're doing it because of the difference that you know that it makes, is I am so grateful that you're doing this work, because it does make a difference, not just in my life, but it makes a difference in all of our lives. And we need you, and we need people like you to step up and do this kind of work. So thanks so much, Nick.
Thank you.
Yeah. And then the last thing is, the creativity habit is based on the idea that everybody is an artist, everyone is creative, and everyone has something to make. So why do you think it's important that we make our thing, that each person make their thing?
Well, I think for a lot of people, they just can't help it. It's just this itch to get out, get ideas out. And I mean, it all just starts in your head. It starts out with an idea, and it can be as simple as humming a song to coming up with code on the computer, or simply placing things around a room. I mean, setting up creative ideas or stories, that happens every day, the way that you use things or see things or simply just absorb things. I think that we can't help but be creative. It's just a matter of noticing that and sharing it.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Nick. Really appreciate it. And good luck with all of it.
Thanks, Daphne. Thanks for having me. It means a lot. Is there any way we could do like one question each with the crew?
Sure. This is very different from any other interview. This is a special treat in my mind, because being that this is a collaborative effort, it's perfect. It's really fitting to be able to then speak with the different people who are part of The Bright Angle. And that's what we're going to do, where each person is just going to answer one question, but it'll give a flavor, a sense of who each person is and their role in The Bright Angle, and add that dimension to this conversation. I'm grateful to be able to do that. So the first person is Lori. Hi, Lori. Welcome.
Thank you.
Tell me what your role is, and we'll go from there.
Well, Nick likes to call me the storyteller. I handle the social media and a lot of the copy, and Nick is really, really good at saying a lot of really beautiful things, and I help him make sense of it and organize it. So that's mostly what I've been doing lately, especially with the Kickstarter, and I help manage the studio as well.
What is it for you about The Bright Angle that's the most inspiring piece of this project? What has made you want to be a part of it?
Well, I moved to Asheville about a year ago, and I moved here knowing that I wanted and needed to work in a studio environment, because I graduated school for ceramics a couple of years ago in 2014, and I felt that, you know, I learned so much in school, but mostly about art and about actually making the work, but not about how to make a living making the work and how that actually worked in real life in terms of professional practice. And so I just felt like an apprenticeship or working in a studio was really essential for me to be able to launch my career and be successful as an artist. So I met Nick through Odyssey Clayworks. I'm a resident artist there, and I was a summer resident at the time. I walked into the studio, and everything was kind of in a pile on the floor. And I kind of just jumped in and started helping him organize. And that's where we started. I did a lot of like cleaning and organizing, just like jumped in doing like whatever I needed to do because I was just happy to be there. And then I kind of moved up in my role as more of like an administrative person and do a little bit less cleaning. So yeah, I feel like I'm thankful every day to be here, and I've learned so much, and Nick's such a great teacher.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hi, Shannon.
Hi.
Hi. So what is your role in the Bright Angle?
So I have a couple different roles. I am, for the Bright Angle, I am the main mold maker. And so what that means is when we design a new product, I then take the 3D printed model that we produce and I make the mold of it. And then essentially I will make a master mold from there and make multiple molds off that master so that they can then be passed on to Tyler for the casting process.
Got it. And for you, what is it that has the most meaning about the Bright Angle?
It's really like the collaborative part of all of us working together. We have a really close, tight-knit team of the five of us, and we all wouldn't have been here without Nick. He's really like the leader, our leader, and has put this all together, but he really works hard to get us all involved in the design making process so that when we do release a collection, you'll see in like the notes or the information that, you know, this was designed in collaboration with Shannon Tovey or Tyler Anderson. And it's just allowing us to be more than just workers and really get us invested in each part of the process.
That's excellent. And Shannon, good luck in London with grad school.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's exciting.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm sorry.
You there, Evan?
All right, hold on 1 second. Oh, okay. Here he is.
There you go. Hi.
Hi, Evan. Great to have you here. This is, I've never done this before. It's really very fun. So, Evan, what is your role with the Bright Angle?
I do a lot of the glaze chemistry stuff and glaze application. That's kind of most of my role.
Okay. And what brought you into it and why are you inspired to be a part of it?
Of the Bright Angle?
Of the Bright Angle, yeah.
I guess I was working with Nick for a while when I first moved to Asheville, and it's a great group of artists here that I was excited to be part of the studio with. Yeah.
What has the most meaning for you about the Bright Angle?
Yeah, I like the environment here. Mm-hmm. And my coworkers and having that. I was working on my own before here, just being self-employed, and that is quite isolating. Yeah, so it's nice to have that collaboration.
Great. Thanks, Evan.
Hello.
Hello, Tyler. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Good. So what is your role with the Bright Angle?
My role is the production manager.
And just say a little bit about what that means.
Yeah, absolutely. So as a production manager, me and Laurie keep track of everything that's going on in the studio, knowing when kilns need to be fired, knowing how many of each particular thing we need to make, knowing how many of those things need to be glazed in which colors, things like that, what molds we need to make more of. Yeah, and that's kind of the gist of it. Also, I'm the one that's doing most of the, I don't want to say most, but a lot of the actual touching of the pots. So we each have our specific roles, and mine involves casting, handling, cleaning up afterwards, these kind of things.
Got it. Okay. And Tyler, what is it for you about the Bright Angle that either really inspires you or has meaning for you around it?
I think being able to design a collection with a bunch of different people whose work is all very different, and to be able to collaborate on a cohesive collection with those people with very, very different styles has been really, really cool. So that's interesting. Like, if you look at any of our solo work, you would have no idea that we all worked on this one collection, because it's very tight. It's very, it's all in the same family. Besides that, just, I enjoy sort of learning by doing. And so working at the Brown Angle has helped me greatly there, where I'm usually a thrower. I throw most of my work. But since I've worked here and have learned a bunch of new processes using the slip, I have created a whole slip cast collection now based on that. Skills that I didn't have a year ago, you know what I mean? Yeah. So being able to do that and grow as an artist, this has given me a huge opportunity to do that as well.
That's great. That's great. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nick, was there anything else that you either wanted anyone else to share, or anything else that you wanted to share?
I think that's it.
Thanks for listening to the Creativity Habit podcast. To read about Nick Mullen's creativity practices, go to thecreativityhabit.com, and you can find me on Instagram over there as the Creativity Habit. And if you choose to participate in the Kickstarter campaign for the Bright Angle, know that there's an option to contribute at the level of a gift membership. This allows you to receive beautiful handmade gifts all year long. As Nick says, quote, "We figure you spend at least $50 six times a year for birthdays, weddings, holidays, and we want to make it easier for you to give a perfect handmade gift with thoughtful design and a compelling story." And coming up next on the podcast, poet Glenys Redmond. In this interview, she shares not only how to come back to yourself through poetry and own your own creative voice, but she also recites several of her own poems that will move you to tears and make your heart sing. And if you like this interview, please leave a review on iTunes. Every review helps inspire more artists, creatives, and makers to get out there and make their thing.